And John Delaney joins us now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
You declared your candidacy for president, well, almost 2 years ago at this point, and you've been in New Hampshire many times now. How have your visits here shaped your ideas of priorities and what you do as president?
Well, it has entirely shaped my priorities in many ways, because one of the things I've been able to do that I think is unique is listen to voters. I mean, I've done climate roundtables in, you know, Portsmouth. I've done educational roundtables at public schools. I've toured healthcare facilities here. I have an opioid roundtable this afternoon. I mean, it's just an example of all of the local input I've gotten from residents of New Hampshire, and it's just really been terrific.
You've been pretty clear that a priority for you is bipartisanship.
I
think that's been a real theme so far of your campaign. You've pledged to focus solely on what bipartisan proposals in your first 100 days in the White House, if elected. Can you tell us about your most significant achievement or something that required real negotiation as a congressperson when you really reached across the aisle?
Sure. Well, a great example is something I did right before I left Congress, which was to craft the only bipartisan carbon tax bill in the Congress. In other words, get Democrats and Republicans together to agree how we can actually put a price on carbon, how we give all the money back to the American people, and how we actually create something that can get done that makes a big difference on climate change. So, you know, that, I mean, I was ranked the third most bipartisan member of the House. And the thing about bipartisanship, it's kind of a means to an end, right? Bipartisanship in and of itself is not a goal. What the goal is to get things done. The goal is to actually do things that matter to the American people. And if you look back, all the great stuff we've ever done as a country has been done when we build big coalitions. And to some extent, I'm a coalition builder.
And you don't see that happening now, obviously.
No, you see people fighting, and you see them not doing anything, and you see the American people paying the price.
But how do you convince voters in a primary, Democratic primary, that this is something that is laudable, that's something we should be going after? You know, we've got a very polarized nation.
Yeah.
We've got parties who are being pulled to their extremes.
And I agree with you. I think the extremes in this country have basically held the rest of us hostage.
So how do you get to those voters in a primary?
So, you know, you have to appeal to people's head into their hearts, right? To their heads, I think they all know this is the right way to be. I mean, at their core, everyone knows this is right. But in their hearts, what they really want to do is beat the president. And I think they also know that someone who can build a big tent and capture the center is the best candidate to beat the president.
But it can't just be about anger against the president.
No, it's not. But again, you know, some people really care about what your ideas are and what your solutions are. And I think relative to any of the other candidates, I've actually really thought through these issues and can show the American people how I can get all these things done and how there's a pathway to progress on all the important issues of the day. But some people in the party really, and I don't disagree with them, think the most important thing is to beat the president, that we cannot have another 4 years with him as our president. And for those people, what I would say is, I agree with you, and I'm the one to beat him. And the reason I'm the one to beat him is because I'm the kind of candidate who can capture independence. You know a lot about independence here in New Hampshire. A lot of your citizens are independents. And I think they're looking for a candidate like me, someone who's a problem solver, who will bring this country together. I think a lot of the reason people are independents is because they're tired of the elected officials putting their political party ahead of their country. And someone like myself, who's pledging in my first 100 days to only advance bipartisan ideas, who's calling for national service as a way of unifying us, who doesn't talk about half the country as if they're entirely wrong about everything they believe. I think those people know that someone like myself is the right person to be our next president. And I think a lot of Democratic voters are going to realize that this election is going to be fought in the center. The president's going to turn out his voters, and he's going to turn out our voters. And so what that means is whoever wins the center is going to win.
Well, what is your take on the increase in proposals from Democratic candidates that would see some fundamental changes to our government? You know, we're talking about this kind of shift a little bit, like changes to the Electoral College, adding justices to the Supreme Court, for example, talk of reparations. I mean, these are things that we're hearing from the left right now.
So listen, I think if we make this election about completely changing the United States of America, that feels really risky to me. If we make this election about putting forth someone who's decent and honest and tells the truth and has real solutions and wants to bring the country together, that feels like a pretty easy election for us to win. So that's kind of how I think about it.
Do you think those kinds of changes, though, are aspirational? Do you think that you want to look at in the future for those kinds of things?
I'm not in favor of these kind of inside the beltway kind of arms race techniques, right? For example, Harry Reid got rid of the filibuster rule to help get Obama judges approved because the Republicans were being obstructionists, which they were. As a result, now the Republicans have been able to approve two Supreme Court justices without really any Democratic support, which is never the way we were able to put people on the Supreme Court. So I think what we have to realize is that while some of this stuff may feel good, like increasing the size of the court, and I get it. Listen, what happened to Merrick Garland was terrible. I think what Mitch McConnell did in blocking a vote on Merrick Garland or a hearing on Merrick Garland was unpatriotic and unconstitutional at some level. But that doesn't mean the right answer is for us to increase the size of the court, because there might be a day when Republicans are in control of the government and they'll just increase it again. And I just don't think that's where we need to go as a country. Where we have to get back to as a country is the reestablishment of the norms in our society. And that's what we've lost in the last couple of decades because of super partisan politics. And again, I think the Republicans in Congress are a lot worse than the Republicans around this country, right? Most Republicans I meet on the trail around the country I can work with. And a bunch of the Republicans in Congress don't really represent them because of all the gerrymandering that's gone on.
So you think that really what we're hearing...
So gerrymandering, for example, we got to get rid of. But that's not a norm in society. That's a recent perversion of democracy, right? So, you know, some of these things are different than... Too much money in politics is a perversion of democracy. Gerrymandering is a perversion of democracy. But court packing is not the answer. The answer is to get rid of gerrymandering and to get rid of some of this money in politics.
But again, that's where a lot of this anger comes from with voters, right, on both
yeah.
sides. But do you feel like we're hearing from the extremes and we're hearing it's out of caliber, or I should say, do you feel like we're hearing more about these extremes, but we're not hearing about kind of a silent majority in the middle?
Yes. And that's unfortunately been true for a while. And we tolerated it as a country. And now we have Donald Trump. Right? Donald Trump, to me, is the punctuation of decades of terrible politics where the extremes have run the country, right? Because their kind of no-compromise approach to politics has created a broken federal government that has failed the American people. And that's why Donald Trump got elected president.
Yeah, well, and Donald Trump was elected president with that fact, but this has been going on for a generation now.
Right, but it kind of came to a head, if you will.
Right, yeah.
You know, because I think of it really simply. Republicans have been messaging to the American people for decades that everyone in Washington is an idiot and a fool. And Democrats, my party that I love, has been messaging to our voters that everyone in Washington's a sellout to some like special interest or corporation. And I think the American people, you know, in 2016 kind of believe that message. Because if you thought everyone was a sellout or a fool, you'd vote for Donald Trump. Because why not?
Have you heard voters in New Hampshire talk about these kinds of big proposals that Democrats have been championing?
Yeah, and you know, but what I hear mostly is they want progress. So I have a big proposal to deal with climate. I have a big proposal to deal with universal health care. The difference between my proposals and some of the others is I can actually show people how we can make them happen. And that's what I think folks in New Hampshire, who I think are very much common sense people.
When you put up those big proposals, though, of course, the first question is, how do you pay for it?
And every one of my proposals is paid for. That's the difference.
Well, let's talk about some
sure.
of those, if we can, for
sure.
a moment. You know, we'll talk about climate change for
yeah.
a minute, your proposal and what you do about it.
So I got three things we should do. The first thing is we should put a price on carbon. And I introduced a bipartisan carbon tax bill, as I said to you. Democrats and Republicans supporting putting a price on carbon, and we take all the money and we give it right back to the American people in a dividend. So it kind of goes out one pocket and back in the other. But meanwhile, we change behavior. And so that bill has been modeled to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 90%. So there's a bipartisan solution. I can get that done my first year as president. And the way I can get that done is with every Democrat and with all the Republicans who live in coastal states. Because maybe some of the Republicans from the middle of the country won't vote for a carbon tax bill, but I can tell you the ones in Florida will. The ones in Georgia will. So that's the first thing I do. The second thing I do is we need to spend a lot more money on basic research. We have to fundamentally innovate our way out of this problem. We need new battery technology, and we need new transmission technologies. And the third thing I would do is create a market for these very exciting technologies that exist called negative emissions technologies. These are machines that actually take carbon out of the atmosphere, literally machines that take the carbon out of the atmosphere, put it back in the earth. We will not get to net zero carbon emissions by 2050 unless we have those technologies. We cannot get off fossil fuels fast enough. So there's a proposal that I just laid out that's a market-based proposal that puts a huge bet on American innovation, which, by the way, if you look back over history, that's how we solve problems. We've innovated our way out of them.
There will be upfront costs to that, though.
They are, but if you, again, those costs, basic research, the best investment the federal government makes by any measure is its investment in basic research. It has, at a minimum, a 2.5 times multiplier in terms of economic effect. So you can see how those proposals can actually get done, right? The Green New Deal, which I admire all the energy, it's basically saying we got to rebuild every structure in the United States of America in the next 10 years. Like, if you and I and everyone else in this country stopped doing everything they were doing and became a building repair person, we couldn't rebuild all the structures in this country, right? So you have to put forth ideas that make sense, that you know how to pay for, and don't involve increasing the energy cost of your average working American by fivefold, which is what some of these proposals do. And what that means is they're just never going to happen.
New Hampshire's low unemployment rate. Employers are having a hard time retaining and recruiting workers right now. What kind of solutions do you have for economic development in rural communities in rural states like New Hampshire?
So we need to do things in the public education system. We need, I think, at least 1 million new apprenticeships in this country. One of the things I've called for is national service, which would involve a big apprenticeship program, right, to have young people kind of rebuild national parks, federal buildings for energy efficiency, all as part of serving their country. I think that would make a difference. I think we need more funding for career and technical training. Right now, a disproportionate amount of our funding encourages people to go to college. And I think we have to balance that out with putting more incentives around people doing career and technical training. And then I think we need a whole agenda for rural America and distressed communities to create incentives for people to invest in these
places. What would that look like?
Well, it's a couple things. There's four things I would do. One thing I already did, which is to lead the bipartisan effort to create the Opportunity Zone legislation. I don't know if you followed that. It's a federal tax incentive that passed that people get effectively a break on their capital gains if they invest in distressed communities. I would pair that with requiring 25% of the government contractors in this country to have half their employees in distressed communities. I would pair that further with a national infrastructure plan with spending more money in distressed communities, things like rural broadband, that kind of stuff. And then I would take something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is by far the best kind of tax program we have in this country for workers. You know, it puts money right in the pocket of workers. I would double that in distressed communities. So those four things working together will turn around a whole bunch of communities in this country.
Why do you think these ideas have not come to the forefront before?
Because no one talks about the things that we agree with each other on. Because that's not good politics. What I just laid out, that those four things to turn around distressed communities, you know, they're real policies. And they get at the problem. They don't involve vilifying the other side. They involve actually working with the other side to solve a common problem, which is that a bunch of our, you know, one of the things, like, think about what happened to our country last year. Last year in the United States of America, 80% of the venture capital, which is considered the smart money, went to 50 counties in this country out of 3,100. 50 counties got 80% of the money. That's a problem. That's not a Democratic problem. That's not a Republican problem. That's not an independent problem. That's a structural problem with our economy. And I think Democrats and Republicans and independents should want to solve that problem together. My solution that I just laid out gets at that problem. But if you notice, it doesn't blame the other side. It's basically the villain in that problem is politics. Because we've watched the world change. We've watched there be enormous concentration of opportunity in this country. And we didn't do a damn thing about it. Why? Because the extremes abhor compromise.
Former Congressman and Democratic presidential candidate John Delaney, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.